So I had a big package, big title, and I was helping big investors to get richer. So at some point I felt like, okay, what's the point? Maybe some other people would really appreciate my help. Maybe they really need more of my CFO advices. Maybe I can help others too. And that's also why I got into fractional CFO, because I wanted this sense of fulfillment actually.
Hello and welcome to the Gross Profit Podcast. My name is James Kennedy. I'm the CEO and co-founder at ProcurementExpress.com today. And weirdly, we are here to talk about that today, at least tangentially. I have invited to the podcast Elizabeth Seba, who is a fractional CFO and someone with a long time experience as a CFO. But we're going to do something a little bit different today. Elizabeth is going to flip the script and ask me a few questions about our background at Procurement Express. So before we get into that, you're very welcome, Elizabeth. Tell us a little bit about yourself and where you are in the world today.
Thank you, James, for accepting me to interview you in your own show. So I am based in Portugal, actually. I have relocated. I'm originally from France. I have over 15 years of experience in corporate finance. And I'm actually a fresh new leaper. I just decided a few months ago to become a fractional CFO.
Okay, well, welcome to the world of entrepreneurship. I'm sure it'll go well for you. I know you're very active on LinkedIn. I'm very impressed with your LinkedIn engagement, but I'll hand it over to you.
So I guess the first question that comes in mind is if you can tell us a bit about yourself, James. Where you come from, your background, but also what type of a man you are.
Okay, well, I'm based in Dublin, Ireland, where I'm speaking to you from today. And I hesitate to say I'm an entrepreneur by training, but running a business has been in my family for generations. And in fact, my great-great-grandfather started a bakery that lasted more than 130 years in Dublin. And at its height, it had more than 700 employees. So I always knew that in my background, I felt like, well, I've got 98% of the same genetics, let's call it, as that guy. And he built a business. So I always believed I could. So I trained. I was a bit of a nerd as a kid, loved computers. I went to train in college and got a degree in computer science. I had one job for about 18 months in doing R&D for a telecoms company called Ericsson here in Europe, in Ireland. But almost straight away, I was in the innovation unit there and I was trying to spin out a product. And so I guess you could say in my background, I was always a little bit contrarian, never that great at school, to be honest. So I had to find another way to win. No one was going to pay me to be their neurosurgeon. So I had to find a different path in life. And that's how we've ended up starting various different companies, mostly terrible companies, if I'm honest, which made no money and crashed and burned. But eventually, many, many years later, I managed to hook up with my business partner, Richard, who we've done a lot of things together. And we started Procurement Express 10 years, almost to the month now, 10 years and 3 months, I think, now at this stage.
Wow, so that's actually not a new company. And you're saying that you started already other companies. How many did you start before getting into procurement?
Calling them companies might be a little bit generous. I can give you a rundown of some of the terrible ideas I've had for businesses. The first thing I did after leaving that R&D company was start selling SMS text messaging services online. So I was one of the very first services to allow you to do web text, you know, so you could send text. And I used to sell that to try and sell it to small businesses. And how that actually started was I saw that in my father's office, he was a lawyer, and he would have dozens and dozens of phone calls every day. And he would be in court in Dublin about seeing clients. And when he came back to the office, there'd be a huge long list of phone calls people to get back to. So I designed a system where his secretary could take the messages and then just text him the messages as they were coming in. So it was a little database, a contact thing, which, you know, would look up the client and get their phone number and put it in and send it to him as a text. And that meant that he could reply to those people on the way back from wherever he was. So he could just get the text on his phone and then he could reply. And, you know, he used it a lot. I never really was great at technology for its own sake, but I really enjoyed seeing it being used in anger and sort of making a difference. And I knew for my dad, yeah, and hardly anybody else, as it turns out, you know, it made it his life much better. He didn't have a long list of people chasing him all the time, and he's a pretty active guy. So it made a big difference to him that he was able to reply to these messages on the way back. So text messaging, ironically, I could have, not to jump ahead, but I could have done with a CFO at the very start, at least someone with some sort of financial or commercial acumen, because the way I was selling it was I was selling a text message for 20 cent or 30 cent, and I was costing me about 10 cent, and I was making 20 cent each time someone was used, but then the volume just wasn't there. So I didn't have the right pricing model. I would sell it to people way, way, way too cheaply. If I had half a brain, I would have figured out that I, you know, to selling millions of these things, and I was selling thousands of these text messages. But it was good in that I learned a lot of that. You're either learning or earning. I started to learn, okay, you can't just write code. You have to learn how to market. You have to learn how to sell. And that got me out into the world, you know, networking in Ireland locally and doing different things. And then, you know, I did all sorts of scams, like not scams, ideas. Like you were probably don't remember this, but like in the early days of text messaging, you could have premium rate text messages. So you could send a message into a number and then you would it could send you stuff back. And it was like almost before the internet. So what I did along with my girlfriend at the time, now wife, was we decided, well, we'll start selling a vocabulary building service called Word Nerd. So people could send a message in and then we would send them on a subscription basis a word a day to help them build a vocabulary. We did this and we took out an ad in newspapers or magazines at the time. And we had a Word Nerd thing there, were quite popular, but we were the only vocabulary building services. And there were hundreds of other ads in the newspaper. All of the other ads were for pictures of good looking boys and girls. Basically people were just, So it turns out there was a much stronger market for pictures of, you know, pretty girls and hunky guys than there was for building your vocabulary. So again, that didn't go anywhere either. So, but I kind of went on in that vein. You know, what I would do is I never had a business model that worked. I'd build a technology, I'd build these things, but I never really thought it through. I never thought, well, where are we going with this? How could I make a salary out of it? How could I just kind of was building things and trying them out there and trying to sell them. And it was very difficult, to be honest, but that eventually, you know, led me to down a path of, at the time, what I found very influential was a guy called Jason Fried, who is the founder of Basecamp, which is one of the very first SaaS businesses. And he had this idea of having hundreds of customers paying you tens of euros a month. I used to say that, probably hundreds of customers paying you thousands of euros a month. And that way you could, you know, build up a cash flow that could support your life. But it wasn't like a job because you had hundreds of customers. So not any, you know, one person couldn't fire you, or if someone didn't use the software, it didn't really matter. But if you had hundreds of customers paying you a little bit of money, it gave you the comfort of a job with the cash flow. And that's what started me down the road of trying to looking at SaaS businesses. And I guess I picked the business model first, and then I started to figure out, well, what business could fit that business model, or what technology or what sales motion, et cetera, could fit that business model. And once I did that, it started to make life easier. At least the financial side of the things that I was building started to work better for me.
Oh, that's very interesting. So you always had something in your mind, right? So you wanted to find that thing that you needed to do. Is that so? I guess that coming from one idea to another and then another one, each time you learn something new, what is it that you think that you were really looking for? Is it to make an impact? Is it to help a specific group of people? What is it actually?
Well, I mean, I like this. This comes down to, I mean, in that very first job, the only job I've ever had, through a series of circumstances, I ended up getting paid a lot of money. I was only 22. But I remember my manager sat me down at one stage and she was quite annoyed with me. And she said, James, you realize you're getting paid more than the president of Ireland. And I was like, well, that feels really good, but you seem quite angry at me. What's wrong? And he says, well, you know, you're not really playing ball. And what was happening was that I had started a project within that company. It was a sort of an innovation project. I had stepped away. They needed me to run it. So they got me to come back to run it. They paid me a lot of money. But the project itself, but partly because I came up with the idea, was a terrible project. It wasn't going anywhere in the long term. But they needed me to pay. And what I realized, you can get paid a lot of money, but not deliver a lot of value. And it's actually a terrible feeling. So there's jobs in the world where actually you can get paid quite well, but you're not delivering value. You basically don't have happy customers. It's kind of worthless. You know, there's a lot of jobs like this. You know, some, I don't want to condemn anyone or call anyone.
No, I understand. Yeah, I understand completely because I had the same feeling basically. So I had a big package, big title, and I was helping big investors to get richer. So at some point I felt like, okay, what's the point? Maybe some other people would really appreciate my help. Maybe they really need more of my CFO advices. Maybe I can help others too. And that's also why I got into fractional CFO. Because I wanted this sense of fulfillment, actually. I wanted something else than just working for money. Money is good and we need that. But that's not the end of the story. That's never the end of the story. So at least for me. So I completely understand your point. So you were actually looking for a sustainable way to help others and make an impact and really add value to others. Is that right?
I saw there's a YouTuber called Ali Abdaal, who is a sort of a productivity YouTuber. And he qualified as being a doctor. And he recently, not so long ago, quit being a doctor to be a YouTuber. And you would think being a doctor is a very high,
yes,
high value. It's a great way to give back, you know, and being a YouTuber, I don't know. But his point was that, you know, an average doctor in the UK saves 7 lives over the course of their career, right? Which is fantastic. I hope I never have to save a life, but I'll never have the opportunity to. But at the same time, he said, if he didn't do it, someone else would just step in and do it. And it makes his own sense of agency feel kind of empty. And whereas as a YouTuber, he's the only guy who can do that. So I feel like, yeah, absolutely. And if you're working in a large organization, you often have that feeling. You feel like, well, I could do this or not. I could do it or not do it. And it won't really matter. And then that's a loss of agency, I think. It's kind of an empty feeling, which sounds like you have come across.
Absolutely. I think, I had the same feeling, actually. So I was working for a multinational, a listed one, and I just felt at some point that no matter what, you're replaceable. So at the end of the day, you're not really building something. That's at least what I realized. So I started to think about what could I do for myself that could also help others more, have some value, and also build, you know, a sustainable life for me, like a life where I would really feel happy, spend time with my son and my family more, not being overstressed, and at the same time help others. And that's why I started, you know, have this jump and started my fractional CFO journey just 4 months ago, which is very, very new.
Yeah.
And you were mentioning that one challenge that you faced was you had the idea and you knew how to do it, but the thing is you didn't know anything about sales or marketing. So that was a different word for you, right? Because you need more than just knowing your stuff when you start a business. You need to know everything that is around. So you're not only providing a product, but you're selling and you're doing the marketing and you're doing the legal stuff as well. So there is a lot of things that is intertwined with you selling your product. So I completely agree, and it makes sense also to me. So at the end, I just want to ask you, what is it that you're selling then, James?
You mean at Procurement Express?
Yes. So now you have your business after all this wonderful experience and, you know, working for all these, those great ideas, and you did a lot of things. So today you built Procurement Express. And what's your product today?
Yeah, so the way I like to think of it, if we're to be all warm and fuzzy about it, is that we send thousands of people home 10 minutes early every day. And the way that we do that is that we help with the ordering process for SMB companies. So if you think of someone who's been told, someone who needs standing in a field, he needs to paint a fence, he needs to buy some paint. And then to get that process from needing the paint to actually having it to do his job, you need to do a lot of stuff. You need to get approval, you need to set the budget, you need to account for it, you need to get it delivered. All of that has to go right. And that's what our software helps to do without the stress. So, you know, in smaller companies, it's just one guy and a can of paint. It's not too bad. He's doing the accounts itself. He can ring the hardware store and get it delivered. But in bigger companies, as you slightly grow, you know, more people are involved. And that's what our software helps, is to help those growing companies to coordinate their purchasing process. And specifically, we do it for people who are, you know, probably 20 to 200 employees. So they, for whatever reason, don't want to buy an ERP. They haven't got the time or the budget or the energy to do it, but they do want to improve their purchasing process for all the reasons we know about. And you know how we send thousands of people home 10 minutes early is that all of the purchasing is organized in one place. So there's not all these crazy WhatsApp messages and emails and questions and auditor follow-ups, et cetera, trying to figure out why the paint was bought and who it's for and did we pay it yet? And did we get an invoice? It takes all those sort of communication overhead away so that people can get on with their job. And that's what Procurement Express does in the best way I've found of explaining it.
Yeah, no, it's actually clear. So I think it's a platform that helps people coordinate their purchasing process, let's say. I was working in a big company where we had different teams split up in different buildings, and we had a huge issue coordinating our purchase orders, actually. So one person would be in a building and would order one item, and then the other one would review that item, but would be based in another building and doing something else, while the third one would actually approve it, and all of that through hard papers, which was crazy because we were a multinational, basically. And crazy to think in that way. Like, we would take one paper really in our hand and go from one person to another and then to the next one until all signatures were on that paper so that we could actually order a thing. And that was a big healthcare company, which means that the medical equipment needed to be ordered for patients. So I let you imagine the stick that it was for us to be able to streamline this process. So that's why Procurement Express talks to me, actually. Having this solution is really incredible for small and medium-sized business because it also enhances internal controls. And for my friends who are watching me and you today as a fractional CFO, I mean, I'm sure they agree that internal controls are really the foundation of all businesses. So that's completely important. That's a good mission that you have there.
Yeah, and a lot of big companies have systems for this, but actually this kind of comes full circle to you talking about fractional CFOs and how they need to grow a business themselves, right? So they're used to getting the accounts out on time and doing cash flow forecasting, and that's all in your happy place. And now you have all these new things, like how do I get a new customer? How do I explain what makes me different? How do I deal with rejection in sales situations? All these things. The reason I enjoy our customers is that they're often growing a business themselves. It's not all very corporate yet. And I think I naturally am attracted to that sort of those businesses. I heard someone years ago on the internet saying, if you don't like frat boys, don't open an Irish pub, you know, so which is another way of saying work with people you enjoy working with and you can deliver value for. And so, yes. that's kind of who we deal with as well.
And that's actually one thing that I like about being a fractional CFO is that I can actually choose who I work with and who I partner with and who I don't partner with. Whereas in corporate finance, it's a bit different because you have a team. That's a team that was chosen by your boss and you need to make it work. So that's a different thing that I appreciate now, being a fractional CFO.
So that's a really good issue. I'm asking you a question. This is one of the questions that really blew my mind when I heard it first. A guy called Jason Cohen, he gave a talk in 2013, and it was about the ideal attributes of a business, you know, so not what the business was, but what it gave you. And you mentioned a few there, that you have control over your time. You get to decide who you want to work with. Who do you enjoy working with most? Like, if you could work with, who's your absolute chef's kiss, perfect person that you would like to work with all day long?
I guess one person that actually has, maybe first, that has a mission, like a real mission. So beyond making money, I'll help him make money, but I'll also help him make an impact. I think that's very important to me. Mm-hmm. And that's why I advise impact-focused businesses. That's what I chose. And then obviously the values. The values are really important as well. And third thing that is really, that can be annoying to me is people who need to micromanage, because I'm a kind of, I've always been like entrepreneur, even if I have more than 15 years experience in corporate, my mind is more of a mind of an entrepreneur actually. Because I know what to do, I know when I have to do it, and I do it, I'm very dependable. So micromanaging, when you work with a CFO, can be difficult for the CFO, if that's a good CFO, I would say. And you have many good CFOs out there. So yeah, I think that makes the difference. Trust doesn't happen in one day. It takes a lot of time to build, and you need that trust to be built between a CEO and a CFO, so that you don't micromanage. And it's very difficult for a founder and a business owner, because you have created everything from scratch and you have a lot of emotions, I guess, in the business, which is natural. So just deciding to delegate is very, very, very difficult. What do you think?
Well, I see frequently it's a very powerful dynamic between, let's see, the CEO-CFO relationship is often, maybe less so in Europe, more in the US, where the CEO tends to come from a sales background. In Europe, it's maybe the CEO comes from a finance background. But yeah, I can see it, the sort of explosive energy of a CEO sometimes can be disastrous on an organization if it's not sustained. And I think the best partnerships are, like, I have friends who are explosive entrepreneurs who get things done, but it's really painful because they're continually going around changing things, ripping things apart, changing their mind, flipping things and going on, you know. And, you know, sometimes they make it just through sheer brute force. But the ideal is if you think of, let's say, you know, Steve Jobs and Tim Cook. Like Tim Cook was the organizer, the facilitator, someone who can take plans. Or to take an Irish example, you know, I have someone who, my business partner, his wife worked in Ryanair for the head of Ryanair, Michael O'Leary. Notoriously disruptive character, and very right. Sort of, and he used to describe how he'd come into the office and then his number two, COO or CFO, would come in and say, okay, he's got a point here, but this is how we're actually going to do it. You know what I mean? We'd make it real. And I think that dynamic can be incredibly powerful. I think then you can manage to combine the creativity and sometimes the lack of disorganization, which is a benefit. But then if you're able to back it up with someone who can pick the best things and then make them happen, that's really an incredible team, you know. So that's what an awesome pair. Yeah, and you need two people who are willing to play those roles and are able to play those roles together. But when you do, it's explosive. I think it's really powerful.
Yes, I think the CEO, as you say, needs to be creative because he has his vision. So he needs to really stay within this vision. He shouldn't have to deal with the practical things as much as the CFO or the COO, as you're mentioning. Because the way I see it is that, so you have this vision, so the CEO has his vision and he has his plan. And then you have the CFO who would just step in and translate that into an actionable plan for the rest of the team. Because when you say, okay, in 5 years, I see myself selling 1 million more product. Okay, that's great, but how do we make that happen? And I think in reality, that's the issue we might face with some of the CEOs, is that they are very, like you say, they're very dynamic and they want to do everything and everything now. But then in terms of priority, you know, all of those ideas need more organization and structure, so that it actually leads somewhere. And so you need someone else, a co-pilot, to actually guide you through your vision and through an actionable plan with actionable steps, so that your team doesn't feel like, you know, confused and frankly lost. because you have so many ideas and you are so creative, which is great. The rest of the team doesn't really know how to make that happen. And your language is actually different from the language of your team. So you need a translator. And most of the time I found myself in situations where I was a translator between the CEO and the rest of the team. I wasn't really making finance. I was actually translating the vision of the CEO in simple terms for everyone to understand, you know, what we actually need to do. And when you have a CFO who is having visions like the CEO, then that's a big trouble because you have both, you know, those two people talking the same language, but really separate from the reality and from the operational reality from the rest of the business. But that's so far what I have seen.
So oftentimes I have privileged access to really what's really happening in the business. And you just have to open the kimono when you're working with your finance team. And obviously they're in that trusted advisor position. And that's why I think oftentimes our most successful fractional CFOs are far closer to diplomats, or let's call them Svengalis, or like communication. They're much better at sort of translation and communication, hardly anything to do with getting the taxes paid or whatever, you know, that's the really, that makes a difference. It's fascinating for people in the finance role to have that privileged role, which is why frequently in Europe, certainly the CFO to CEO roadmap is quite well mapped out. So yeah, it's interesting. Yes. I've learned a lot doing this podcast, talking to CFOs.
Okay, because my next question was actually, what do you think a CFO is?
We've talked about it a little bit, but it is far closer to a diplomat, I would say. And a diplomat is a skilled communicator. As someone is, like you mentioned, able to adapt a vision into a plan. And then also is able to push back at the right times in the right way. So it has a way of sort of working with everyone on the leadership team. Because, I mean, in the worst incantation, working in the finance team, oftentimes depends on the business, you end up having to say no a lot of the time, right? So it's the ability to do that, but then keep people on track with the right vision. So I think I've learned there's many different types of CFOs. Some people focus on a technical area, like, I know, SaaS accounting, for example. Some people focus on like almost a business objective, like a sort of a business brokerage type of, you know, to do with M&A and that sort of thing, and increasing shareholder value. And then there's other people, sounds a little bit like you, who are focused on the value delivery and the mission, which is the most important thing. And it makes it kind of fascinating, actually, because each person has a particular fit. You know, you need someone to find the right type of CFO. You could easily have, if you wanted to fit easily, you could have like four or five people to fill all of those roles. You're not going to get all of that in the one role. So you have to decide which one is the right fit for your business. What do you need to succeed? Which is an interesting challenge on the other side of it. I think when you're selling CFO services, it's a very much understood role. And because there's such variety, when you actually look at person to person, like helping mm-hmm. people make a buying decision around who could work best for them is harder than you might think. I know in one of the conversations I had, a standard move that a private equity firm will do when they purchase a business is to put in the CFO role straight away, because it's really pivotal and it can often be a force multiplier for a lot of businesses. People, you know, businesses that are kind of stumbling around making money, God knows how, you know, they're doing it. A CFO is one of the most highly leveraged positions you can put in, depending on what you need, you know? So yeah, that's what I've learned. I couldn't tell you how to hire one, but that's what I've learned so far.
Did you see, and that's actually accurate, that did you see like common grounds between all those CFOs that you have interviewed? And I think you have made like maybe more than hundreds of interviews of fractional CFOs so far. So do they all have something in common?
Well, here's the thing. It's the, let's parse out, let's say the successful ones. What do the successful ones have in common? And it's this communication ability, you know, ability to deliver good and not so good news in a way that keeps everyone on board and is able to maintain relationships no matter what's going on, in good times and bad. And I feel like it's a lot calmer. I've noticed that the people, like the CFO that I've seen that are great, are the ones who remain calm and in control, know what's happening, when no matter what's going on. I think the CFO or the leadership as a whole, but maybe even, you know, the founders need that trusted person that they can sort of be themselves with. Oftentimes there's a lot of masks you need to wear. Sometimes you're with a customer, sometimes you're with the team. Think about what you're saying. You can't always say directly what's on your mind. That's kind of controversial to say, but that's just the way it is. You know, you have to think about how the message will be received. I think a great CFO is someone who really you don't have that. So you can feel like, okay, well, we can really just tackle this problem, talk about everything that's happening exactly the way it is, and then create solutions. So I think that's what I'd say, is that people who manage to cultivate this feeling of trust and confidence is an attribute I've seen of the best, most high-functioning CFOs I've met.
Yes, I think you're right, because the synergy between the CEO and the CFO is really crucial. Building that relationship of trust means that we can say to each other directly what's wrong and what's doing good. And then we can find really solutions without having to hide in nice terms or something. We know each other and we know that we have the same goal at the end of the day. I think that's really important. So the relationship is very important. And I think also the relationship with the rest of the team is also very important, because you need someone to be there for the team, to engage the team, to motivate the team. After all, the company is nothing without people. And so this is also very, very important. And maybe we don't talk much about that, actually, the leadership skills. And leadership skills for me is really not faking it, because you have lots of people who tend to fake this image of, you know, I care about my team and I want them to be happy and so on. So those are beautiful words. But what do you do in practical every day for that? Do you support your team when they are stuck with the decision, when they are stuck with the tools? What do you do to make things progress? And I think CEO and CFO should really be always hand in hand. So they should have one voice, basically. The CFO should know what's important to the CEO and the CEO as well. So it's really a mutual relationship. And I agree with you on that. So yeah, so that's one thing. And I was wondering today what your accounting or finance department looks like, actually.
Sure. So, I mean, we've grown from 2 customers to almost 300 now. Running a SaaS business is a very famous talk called the Long Slow SaaS Ramp of Death. And contrary to what you might read in TechCrunch, a lot of SaaS businesses take a long time to build up their cash flow. And yeah, once you get there, it's great, but it takes a long time. So, you know, our accounting has started off myself and Richard just doing it directly, doing the bookkeeping, and then we've evolved over time. We actually went through phases. We had our bookkeeping in-house at one stage, but we found that actually it was better to work with for tax reasons, we have an accountant in Ireland, and then we have another sort of on our finance team, Billy, who's based down in South Africa, and he does the monthly preparations. And now over time, Billy has sort of grown. He's gone from just, I won't say doing the data entry, but like doing a lot of the, you know, getting the management accounts done every month. And now over time, he's starting to skill up more in terms of specializing in terms of SaaS accounting. We also work with Anthony from SaaS Gurus, who helps us with structure of our reporting. So there are particular things in SaaS businesses, you know, CAC, cost of acquiring a customer, or lifetime value, all these things which need to be, you know, measured and which can be helpful in decision making. So now we're at the stage where we have, you know, all those people involved, as well as so that's basically sort of 4 people working on all on a functional basis, working on different parts of the business of that. And then of course we have the payroll, so there's another person. So even though we're a small company, we have 5 people working fractionally on different parts of it. So some of that is like payroll in South Africa, payroll in Ireland. Then there's the specialized SaaS piece of it in keeping it, you know, getting our metrics right. And then there's the day-to-day, just getting our management accounts and our quarterly board meetings prepared for and so on. So that's the structure that we have right now.
So that sounds like it really evolved in a professional way now, in a structured way. Did you see the value of having those reports, management accounts, and this structure in your business in terms of really concrete value?
Well, I'll tell you, the journey there, I mean, at the beginning, we were default dead as a company, right? So we raised a small amount of money. Like I mentioned, it takes a long time to build up cash flow in a SaaS business. So we were default dead. So at the early days, really all I cared about was selling. We were all just selling, and it's a sales and marketing machine, just trying to get enough cash in to do it. Once we've gone beyond that step, you know, we've become slightly more established. Then it's become far more about, like, we do our management accounts. Like, the big first step there is it's very different, the tax accounting, what we need, the way we need to report in order to do our taxes versus what we need to grow the business and manage the business. So, and where we've come to there is we pretty much, even though we're a SaaS business and we have accrued revenue and so on, and we need to depreciate things like development costs, really, we look at our month-to-month on a cash perspective, and then the accrual accounting comes more into force for the tax at the end of the year. Yeah, that's kind of where we are. Now, I guess the biggest change really in terms of sea change is no one likes to talk about the B word, budgeting, but that is what has been a change more recently. A friend on the board, Ronan, he's a finance director in a large company, and he's always asking, oh, we should be doing a budget change. Yeah, where's your budget? And we talked about it, and we had one in name. But once we turned to profitability and trying to have profit targets, that's where the budgeting has really come in. And now, this year, I'd say probably, I'm ashamed to say, but 10 years later, it's probably the first year we've really had budgets would have had teeth, and I can see the value in anything. Once you get to that stage, I feel like you're starting to manage the business from a finance perspective. I'd never felt that before. I'd always felt like we're just trying to get a customer in and trying to do whatever and run around. And I like it. I like it being able to say, okay, you're able to make better decisions around trade-offs around, well, what? Okay, I know, for example, we should have an ICP, an ideal customer profile, but then how affects how you're making your spending decisions for the next 12 months is good. And I guess at the very beginning, you're just trying to survive month to month, quarter to quarter. And then as you start to be able to grow beyond that, you can make slightly longer term decisions for the business, which I think is healthy. When things are in growth, it's easy, like a rising tide raises all boats. But things like COVID come along, then when you're working with your budgets, you feel much calmer knowing, okay, I know what I have to do. You can decide in your mind, you can pre-decide, okay, if this happens, I'm going to do that. If that happens, I'm going to do this sort of thing. And then when it happens, you're not panicked because you feel like, okay, I know I planned for this. This is what we're going to do. And we just go and do it, you know? So budgeting has been powerful. I feel like it's the first time now. It's only once that we got to budgeting. I feel like we've been using our accounts to make decisions in the business. Before, it had just been keeping us out of jail with the government, to be honest. And that's the unlock, you know. And I think I don't think I'm alone in saying most businesses never get to that stage. You know, you never get to a stage where you're truly controlling your business from the finance team, you know. So I can sort of recommend it if you like. It feels much more in control, feels much calmer. I sleep better at night.
So you found actually peace of mind through, you know, planning ahead your business and really doing strategy around your finance, because you have some kind of control when you plan things ahead. And that's the planning part that has helped you find peace at night.
Yeah, you can spend almost any money you want acquiring a customer. And then having guidelines around that in deciding what you're going to spend to acquire a customer is super important. And you can only make that decision truly when you have your finance team in order. You know, like, we're a software company, but in truth, most software companies are 50, 60, 70, 90% sales and marketing. That's the thing. Like, building the tool is the one thing, but then actually acquiring customers is the expensive part. And to do that, you need to be in control of your finances. It's hard to avoid it, you know?
You actually did say all the right things there, James. So thank you for that. Because I hope that not only other fractional CFOs will see this, but also other CEOs hopefully will see also this interview today. It's exactly what I have witnessed also throughout all these years with working with business owners, family offices, SaaS company, like you have there. You know, it's so critical for companies at some point to grow internally with their external growth. You have some companies after 10 years who have grown and have, you know, hundreds of customers, but inside, internally, they haven't really dealt with structuring properly their finance and their business. I have witnessed chaos, actually real chaos. And I can see that you have built a business and that business seems healthy and seems on track with everyone that you see there. I have proper indications that, you know, it's on track and it's healthy. So yeah, that's great. Great to hear, you know, a CEO who has done things, you know, right, and who is seeing the true value of finance. So that's great. That's great to hear that. Thank you for sharing. I guess some other things maybe that would be interesting for fractional CFOs to hear about is, so what I've learned so far after 4 months is, like you say, acquiring clients is very, very difficult, costly, especially when you're on your own. So I guess maybe if you have an advice for fractional CFOs, because I know I'm spending a lot of time, a lot of energy, and also money trying to acquire clients. So where should we start? You're a CEO, and you probably have a community with other CEOs where you talk about finance and so on. And fractional CFOs, perhaps you talk about us as well, as we do for our CEOs. So I was wondering, do you have any advice on how to tackle and approach CEOs, talk about their finances? What do they really want to hear from fractional CFOs? I don't know. What are your thoughts?
Yeah, well, okay. But this comes down a little bit to what you want to be as a fractional CFO yourself. I mean, Ben Mickey, who is on the podcast, he has a very strong pitch, which is approach which mightn't be right for all fractional CFOs, but his stance is basically, you know, a CFO is the only person who can, you know, triple the value in your business in, like, say, 3 years, let's say, and you know, let's say using an M&A strategy. But one of the things he really says that really sells well is he says, listen, you can give your fractional CFO any financial outcome you're looking for, no matter, you know, how crazy or whatever. You can just decide, well, what is it you're looking for, you know? And that can be, you know, the health of your business. It can be for you personally, and it can be an outcome. It can be a dollar amount. It can be a number of staff, a number of customers, or whatever. And then if a CFO is the one who can bring the model to achieve that, you know? And now, so you go and do that work, but they can often have skills that you just won't be available to you. Like, you know, things like, I'm immediately unsure of what I'm talking about even here, because there's a bag of tricks that a CFO brings that a CEO just will never have. Relationships with bankers, you know, opportunities for looking at how M&A could be used, how the team can be better aligned. So I guess what I'm saying is that most CEOs don't understand the breadth of the bag of tricks that a CFO has, like things like even being better aligned with your team, sometimes like getting on better with the team, having a better atmosphere in the team, getting everyone on message, working towards the same goal. A lot of people want that, you know. I guess the best piece of advice I ever heard in terms of business and trying to grow a business is business is easy, right? You find out what people want, you go and get it, and you give it to them. But the thing that people get it wrong is they don't do it in that order, right? So they decide, let's take the CFO example there. They decide, you know what? You need budgets. You need budgets. You really should have budgets. And you run around trying to look for people who want a budget. Quite difficult to do because no one wants to actually buy a budget. They want the outcome, right? So it's much actually easier to meet with CEOs and ask them, well, what are you looking for? Are you looking for an extra holiday house? Are you looking for a better aligned team? Are you looking for a business outcome in particular, you know? And then listen to that and just say, yeah, I can, did you know a really good CFO can help you do that in this way, you know? So I would say if you're trying to, you know, reach out to find people to do that. Last year, I went to a CFO forum in Prague, which was quite eye-opening for me because I was not from that world. And I went and I was there and I said, oh, this is quite interesting. And the obvious thing to do is to go to events where entrepreneurs or CEOs are, you know. So you have organizations like Entrepreneurs Organization, have lots of startup events. There's one there in Portugal, very famous, Web Summit. CEOs are often quite extrovert, sales-driven, and you'll find them at their events. One piece of advice, let me just still attempt it, is get out of your comfort zone. Pick, let's say, I don't know, extraction industries conference. Let's say mining, right? Say, okay, mm-hmm. pick a conference on mining. Show up as a CFO, talk to people, say, I know nothing about mining. I'm just a finance, I work in finance, so I'm here to find out. And then ask people, what would you like? What are you missing? And then listen to that and see, well, did you know a finance person could actually do that for you? You know, you want a better aligned team. You didn't know that a finance person can, you want someone, you're running around trying to define your vision and no one's listening to you. Did you know that your finance, a great CFO can help make that happen? Your staff are always giving out that you're changing your idea and changing your mind and doing whatever. Did you know a great finance person can help you all get aligned in the same direction at the same time? And that's what I do.
Yeah, that's actually a great piece of advice because people don't know what they don't know, as they often say. So I think it's really true because maybe they need someone, but they are not aware that they need, you know, a CFO. And attending events and really in person helps to build that trust because they have seen you, they know you, they have seen your body language as well. It's really important for people to see all of that together. Okay, that's a nice advice. And how would you choose between one CFO and the other one? What's really important for you as a CEO?
Yeah, I mean, clearly it's a soft skills choice, I think. So it's going to be the person you feel like is, I mean, you mentioned their mission, vision, values are very important. What someone you feel like has energy for what you're trying to do is aligned that way. How we hire is values first. So we have five values. We have values that not everyone would agree with or be interested in. So we have things like relentless improvement. We have one that's don't be an asshole, play to win, you know, don't let anybody fail. And these features, these our values are not for everyone. Some of them, you know, we swear in one of them. Some people don't like that. We say relentless improvements. That's it sounds a bit hardcore for some people, you know. But what we do is for any role, and this would be, you know, I've learned that this is far easier to do it this way, is to find the people who are attracted to those values and like the idea. They get lit up by the way it's written. They look by, lit up by the language and people who are attracted mm-hmm. to that. And that helps you to find people like you're saying, even if what the business does changes, if you can agree on the values, it makes it's very empowering. So you don't have to worry about micromanaging to your point. Like if you know people have the right values, you can just work to those values and then you can get on and everyone can do their job. And then using the values to hire that way is, you know, hiring is tricky and it's the only way I've found to make it more engaging for everyone. I don't know, you must have done a lot of hiring in your time where, you know, you're sitting there, you're asking questions like, you know, what's your biggest weakness? And they're saying, I work too hard sometimes. And everyone's like, yes. This point, you know, like a mask. And I feel like when you focus on the values, you say, okay, relentless improvement. What have you learned about, how are you learning in the last 6 months? You know, what have you done in the last 6 months to work better? Or don't let anybody fail. Like, tell me about a time that, you know, someone on the team wasn't getting it done and how did you help them? You know, and that mm-hmm. that helps make the decision. So
yes, okay. Yeah, I understand now completely. One also important thing that you highlight there is that so we shouldn't be so much focused on technical. Of course we should be good at technical. That's not what a CEO would be looking for first, right? Because budgeting, all of us, we know how to do it. Forecasting, all of us know how to do it. Financial modeling as well. So that's not the area where you can really differentiate as a CFO, if you're a fractional CFO.
Well, and the last thing you want is, I mean, the fear, I guess, is the archetype of the finance person is just saying no all the time. Like you don't want, see, you know, I think your point about being mission driven, the point is you can achieve a lot more with an excellent CFO than you could without. And that's the thing you focus on. I mean, getting the taxes paid and getting people paid on time and stuff is all table stakes. And that's the real difference between, let's call it a bookkeeper or there's a place for that. In that role, inherently, there are deficiencies. And typically the one is around follow-up, right? So they would have an idea and they'll start things, but they know they're weak on follow-on. They do something for a week, 2 weeks, 3 weeks, 8 weeks maybe, but then they haven't got the energy. They can't keep the energy up to follow up. And saying to a CEO, these things, initiatives you want to start, you want to start them if they're a good idea, and then have someone to back you up, to push you over the edge when you need that extra impetus to get things done, not just have a load of your typical entrepreneur stories, like a load of broken projects around them, all half done projects, which none of them could have won. A little bit like me at the start when we talked about all the terrible businesses I half started, you know. You need to, I have an expression which is, it gets boring before it gets profitable. And you need someone to help you go through that valley of despair and get out the other side of being, you know, making things work. And I've come to learn a great CFO is someone who can help you do that.
No, nicely said. Get things done, actually. Back you up for getting things done. I think that's a nice finish line, is I would say. Yeah, I think it's really great to have heard your story, actually. So not only your background, but also your journey as an entrepreneur. I'm now on the other side because I was an employee and now I am the entrepreneur. And things that I have seen with entrepreneurs before as an employee, changing their minds constantly, repositioning and so on, that was really exhausting for an employee. Then now I get to experience it myself and change my mind and reposition. So it's really, you know, nothing is there by chance. It's really, everything is explainable. And when you go from one side to the other, then you understand much more. And I think now, as a fractional CFO and as all fractional CFOs, I think what's interesting with us is that we do understand entrepreneurs, or at least we should understand them. So it's better for us to serve them. So that might be my word for the end. Thank you so much, James. It was really enlightening. And thanks again for allowing me to interview you in your own famous show. I hope that this all will be interesting for a lot of people, CFOs, CEOs, and more and beyond.
Thanks very much, Elizabeth. I think you're pretty smart when it comes to your marketing as it comes. So I think you're going to do great finding lots of clients.
Thank you. And we keep in touch, hopefully.